Okay, good evening, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, and all those ships out at sea. This is SouthCars, South Coast Amateur Radio Service. This net is conducted under the guidelines of the SouthCars organization and further follows the rules outlined in FCC Part 97 and good amateur practice. The SCAR server is supplied by the Great Lakes Reflector System, that's provided by KB8ZGL, and all contacts and requests for information will be handled through the net control. When contact with another station is made, please move off this system and establish your contact direct so the net may continue. In fairness to all, short-time stations will not be recognized as such. All stations will be worked in the order in which they checked in. Information regarding our HF operation may be found at www.southcars.com and for our digital operation at www.voip.southcars.com. Your net controls are going to be several here this evening. Kathy, K6SUN, our net manager, will be the primary moderator for this evening's session. I will be working with her also, and I'm Gordon, KY6V, reporting in for duty here from Central Florida, and we're backed up this evening by Mr. Syracuse, and that would be Gary, KC2RMO, up in the frigid north. Prior to starting, I would like to ask if there's any emergency traffic or anything out of the ordinary that needs to be handled at this time. If so, call now, please. Okay, that's good. Everybody's staying inside, too, I'll bet, because it's cold. How about birthdays? Anybody having a birthday today, last week, this coming week? We'd like to put you right up in front of the parade if you are. If so, call now, please. Okay, once again, we're not getting any older. This is the Sunday, or excuse me, the Saturday, SouthCars VOIP Global Family Hour, and the intent of this net is to encourage members, their families, and their friends worldwide to enter into an informal social net highlighting third-party traffic through the members' station. Our program for this evening is going to be covering the 72nd year after the incident, if I can call it an incident, the catastrophe that happened on December 7th, 1941, called the bombing of Pearl Harbor, when the Japanese came in with a sneak attack and tried to do us a number. And they did a pretty good job, at least early on. Okay, Kathy, I'm going to turn it over to you to get this thing started. I need to make a slight remark to Gary before I do. Let me buy a nickel. Gary, I've been monitoring, as you know, the admin text box. And Pearl Bailey had a song written for her, which I'm sure that you remember, Gary, and you can comment on this later. It's Pearl Bailey, Won't You Come On Home? You do the cooking and I'll pay the rent, and on went the song. Go ahead, Kathy, KY6V, over.
Well, this is Kilo 6 Sierra United November, and Gordon, thanks so much for opening the session and for that comment about Pearl Bailey. You know, I want to welcome everyone to our SouthCars Global Family Hour. But before I do, let me just give you my temperature. It's 74 currently in Vero Beach, Florida. Dark out there, but it has been a beautiful day today. It was a high of about 78, and you know, it's not like those frigid temperatures up north. Gary says he's in about the 20s, and Rick probably is a lot lower than that, and I heard Earlene was in the single digits, so hopefully all of you are well this evening. But I want to welcome once again everyone everywhere. Now remember, that includes all those fine ladies and gents out there, and those children who may be listening in that third-party traffic, those concerned veterans out there, and all those ships out at sea. Join us tonight for a very special celebration of the remembering of Pearl Harbor, which incidentally we all know occurred actually today, 72 years ago, on December the 7th, 1941. and should be celebrated every year on this date. So, where were you? Were you born? Do you have memories from your parents or grandparents? Have you studied in history class in school? And we want to hear any of those special comments. We sure hope you come aboard. But right now, let's remember for a few moments of Pearl Harbor with just a few moments of silence. All right. Now, before we continue, let me share an activity I shared with my students on Friday. I teach at two separate schools, but this one is the children at Data House. You know, we watched a small clip on Pearl Harbor. Actually, it wasn't too small. It was 51 minutes. From a Discovery Streaming, which is a part of St. Lucie County's website. But I also went into www.history.com. And you know, we completed a raft activity, and I'm going to explain a little bit about this activity and actually what I asked them to do. For those who have no clue on this activity, it is where the student puts themselves in the position of that character. So, for example, as the survivor with the audience of their family, using a specific format on a related topic. So I gave my children a choice on their role, their audience, their format, and their topic. So I want to share this with you this evening, and you at some point can put yourself in this special role that I had my children do. So I'm going to drop it before I go into that. And once again, welcome tonight. This is Kilo 6 Sierra United November. I gave my children three roles, three different things they could write an activity on. One, they were the role of the historian, and they were talking to a student. They had to write a newspaper article. So I asked them, what can you tell me about Pearl Harbor and what happened on December 7th, 1941? Another one, they were a historian, but they were the audience was going to be the survivor, and they were going to do an interview. We wanted them to elaborate on their experiences. How did they feel? What went through their mind during, before, and after the attack? And what could they have changed? And the final scenario was they were a survivor. They were going to talk to their family. They were going to send a letter or a postcard, you know, and the topic was, how did it happen? Your thoughts at the moment, what would you have done different in your life before, during, and after the attacks? And, you know, I will tell you in a little bit that they found this very, very interesting. Now that you've heard from me and my students, I know we have one station and one individual, very important individual, that was in Pearl Harbor at the time of the event. And I want to call on him first to share with us before we go further. So, Mr. Gordon, KY6V, would you like to come aboard, share your experience during this time? And then after that, could you please ask for check-ins? KY6V, come aboard.
Well, thank you, Miss Sunshine. Good evening to everyone once again. Gordon here, KY6V, reporting in from Central Florida. We're about 75 degrees and going down to about 61 tonight, from what I'm being told. And everything's looking pretty good. We had a decent day. I noticed this evening that the Invest 90L tropical disturbance, which was doing about 45 miles an hour of wind velocity out in the far eastern Atlantic, has disappeared, dropped off the radar. So I guess more to see on that, but that's a good sign. Well, Kathy, as you know, I was born in the islands, in the Hawaiian Islands, and there when Pearl Harbor happened. I was born in Hilo, Hawaii, on January 21st, 1937. So this makes me 77 next month. And further shows I was a month and a half short of my fifth birthday on December 7th, 1941. Let me buy a nickel here. So even though I was only 4 years old, I remember this day vividly. My father, Kathy and gang, was managing the Kona Telephone Company on the Big Island, which was 125 miles from ground zero at Pearl Harbor. As you can recall, this was a Sunday morning, and I was out riding in a company truck with my father. He had the car radio on when the program was interrupted and the announcement made of the Japanese attacking the ships and the airports on the island of Oahu. My father immediately turned the truck around. He headed back to the phone company's central office. And I can tell you that the stir of the moment had adrenaline flowing in most of the islanders. It was less than an hour, believe it or not, where we had a squad of National Guard soldiers camped and guarding the central telephone office. Our house at that time was on the same property as the central office, so suffice to it be said that wet behind the ears, four-year-old me had a bird's-eye position to the locals' goings-on. I visited the Arizona Memorial Cafe. I have stories about my father's bomb shelter, but we'll keep this all for later in the program, should time permit. So, if we can take a pause here, I will, at your instructions, pull in some check-ins for the evening. Stand by, please. Okay, suffixes only, that's the routine. Gordon here for South Cars, Family Global Hour. Anybody like to check in at the early stages here? Over.
RMO.
Won't you come home, Pearl Bailey? Go ahead, and good evening to you, sir.
Won't you come home, Pearl Bailey? Won't you come home? Well, good evening, Gordon and Kathy and everybody else. It's like, what do you know about Pearl Harbor? Well, she used to sing with Cab Calloway. You know. Here we are in beautiful sunny Syracuse. We're on the Syracuse 2020 plan tonight, where we have a low of 20 degrees and a 20-mile-an-hour wind, and I don't know what that knocks the windshield down to. But baby, it's cold outside here in Syracuse's beautiful outer Comstock section. It's good to be here. This is a great topic. Especially having Gordon here, because this is what I just think is amazing, to be a little kid growing up in a place like Hawaii. You're the whole world that you see around you is paradise, and to go from this incredibly idyllic situation into a war instantly like that, to be transformed like that, has to be an incredible experience for a young kid. And to hear the story told through Gordon's eyes is remarkable. I love to hear living history like this. Kathy asked the question, what was I doing on that day in 1941? I was just finishing up my prior lifetime at that point. So I wasn't on the scene, but I enjoy hearing the story told by Gordon and those that had been there. It was an incredible day in American history, and I'm waiting to hear more. So with that, we'll turn it back to the net. This is KC2RMO. Back to you, sir.
Okay. Thanks, Gary. We'll have to get together with Pearl Bailey the next time we have an opportunity to be together and do a little picking on that song. Sounds great, sir. Thank you. Any other check-ins before I turn it over to the master's ceremony, that being Kathy? Over.
X-ray, Charlie, X-ray.
And that would be Mr. Mount Dora. Hello, Woody. Go ahead, sir, and good evening.
The other Central Floridian. Okay, I like that. How can you be Central Florida when I'm Central Florida, right? Well, we're right down the road from each other. I tell you what, but it's been a while since I checked in here, and I'm very interested in this topic tonight. You know, I didn't realize that today was the day, the anniversary, until I logged on to you guys tonight. I think this is going to be a really good one, and I'm really looking forward to hearing about it. This and My dad joined the Marines right after that. This is N5HCX. Back to that.
Well, that's great, Woody. I recall you mentioning your dad being in the Marines. Did he see a duty in the Pacific campaign of World War II, or what, sir?
Well, he was one of the original flag raisers on Iwo Jima, you know, before they took the picture. So, but he didn't get in on the picture, unfortunately. I think it was a little too dirty and messy for that. Over.
Oh, that's great. He said that he saw some heavy-duty involvement then. I've been on Iwo, Woody. Just a touch-and-go type situation on an amphib. I was stationed on a little island called Chichijima, which was just north of Iwo Jima. And on my return back to the mainland through Guam, we did a touch-and-go. I call it a touch-and-go. I think we were on the ground all of about 5 minutes and then airborne again. So I can at least say that I've been there. Thank you, sir. Any other check-ins before we send it back to Kathy? Over. Okay, Miss Sunshine, the gavel is yours. KY6V to K6SUN.
Well, thank you so much, Gordon, for picking up those check-ins, and I'm sure we'll get many more throughout the evening. But if, you know, you haven't had a chance, I suggest that everyone look at some of the video that's out there. National Geographic had a fantastic video I wanted to show my children, but for some reason, Gordon, it wouldn't load into our computers, and it was about 45 minutes, and a lot of interviews with those survivors, but the one that I showed was our Discovery streaming, and like I said, it was 51 minutes. My children at Data House were so intently focused on that and not doing anything else. And after that, I got several comments, and maybe I'll throw that out there this evening. But one of their comments to me, Gordon, was one of the children asked about all the ships that may have not been completely destroyed, of whether, you know, I know a lot of them were restored. And so he wanted to know, are they still around, and where would they be? And so I told him that I really thought that at some point they would decommission them, maybe sink them. Maybe they were dive sites. You know, maybe they turned into museums. Do you have any clue on that, since you've been around longer than I have? Do you have any clue on some of the ships maybe that were restored, and what happened with them? Back to you before I go on.
Well, Kathy, I'd have to do some research to be clinically correct, politically correct on what I'm about to say. I know for a fact that a number of the ships that were involved in the situation at Pearl Harbor were retrofitted and went back into the action of World War II. There were some that their damage was so much that it couldn't be. Obviously, you know about the Arizona sinking with over 1,000 people on it, and it's still there as a memorial site. The Oklahoma is another one that transferred position in the lineup at the docks, and it ended up on the head of the row, and they got hit twice, and they had all their portholes open, as I recall. And this ship actually rolled over. And speaking from memory, I think there was 400-plus fatalities because of that situation. They finally hauled her up at some time past Pearl Harbor and sent her off to the junkyard because she was just too damaged to try to repair. And they salvaged her for scrap iron and that kind of thing. So I didn't really answer your question specifically, but that's where the cookie crumbles. I will tell you, let me buy a nickel, that there is what I call a hellacious size mothball fleet of Navy ships anchored just north of San Rafael. San Rafael is a small city just north of San Francisco. Its docks are in the San Francisco Bay, of course. And there's just rows and rows and rows of W-2 ships that are in there. It's amazing to see them just sitting there and getting rusted, I guess. Go ahead, Kathy, KY6V, over.
Well, thank you so much, Gordon, once again. You know, it would be interesting to research that this weekend, because the children I have at Data House, and I've talked to you about them quite a bit, their house, they're 24 hours, not allowed to get too much on internet. Read books a lot, but to have that question asked of me and to have the interest these children had, I would sure like to give them some kind of clue, so I may have to check that out also. So we're going to talk about that day. I want to share that fateful day 72 years ago with you. Many of you have researched this. You've had it in school. If you took world history or U.S. history, you probably studied this. But I'm going to go through it with you. And then once again, Gordon, if I may, I'll throw it back to you for comments and check-ins. But on Sunday, December the 7th at 1941, or the year 1941, at 7:55 a.m., the sky over Pearl Harbor on the beautiful Hawaiian island of Oahu darkened with a wave of attacking a Japanese aircraft. Approximately 360 Japanese planes attacked military installations on the island. The assault lasted nearly 2 hours. When it was over, sources estimated that more than 2,300 U.S. military personnel had been killed. Overwhelming death and destruction was everywhere. Enemy aircraft came out of the sky with their guns ablazing. People living on the island were like sitting ducks in a pool, targets with no place to go. When the smoke cleared, one could see that the harbor was an inferno, with men jumping, attempting to jump to safety from burning and sinking ships. Let me drop it here for a moment. And I do want to comment on what Gordon was talking about, the Oklahoma. During that video I showed my children, it was some information that I was not aware of that I'll share before we close this evening. 8 battleships had been destroyed or severely damaged, along with 3 light cruisers, 3 destroyers, and other vessels. The Arizona took with her a crew of 1,177, and those brave men will remain forever entombed on the Arizona in the waters of Pearl Harbor. At least 170 planes were also destroyed in the attack. The Arizona took a direct hit. The assault involving more than 350 planes came in 2 major waves. In the first wave, torpedo planes targeted the docked Pacific Fleet. The air torpedoes used by these planes were equipped with rudders, which allowed them to operate in shallow water, such as a harbor. The second wave was composed of dive bombers and Zeros, perhaps the best fighter aircraft used in World War II. Zeros had an enormous range, able to fly more than 2,500 kilometers, which is 1,560 miles, from their aircraft carrier. They were also agile, able to engage in steep climbs and drops. And let me drop it here for just a moment. Going back to the video I showed my children, there were reasons that when they came up with the information that we were not aware of what happened. We had very unskilled people at the radar. They decided to turn off the radar, so they were not detected by radar. They were also going through a mountain range, which the Japanese knew would not be detected. It was on a Sunday when people were churchgoers or they were with their family. They knew that the bases would not be manned. So there's a lot of things that the Japanese checked out before they actually went through with this. You know, the sinking of the Arizona, the greatest naval loss in American history, is symbolic of the attack on Pearl Harbor. The bombing was a complete surprise. American military personnel were involved, like I said, typical early morning duties when the attack began, such as getting ready for morning colors, church services, day-to-day duties, preparing to raise the flag. On the battleship Nevada, they were playing the Star Spangled Banner as the torpedo planes were gliding in. Only a few weeks earlier, a Japanese envoy visited the U.S. to negotiate with the Secretary of State. They discussed Japanese troops in Indochina. Japanese exploits into the British and the Dutch East Indies and the Philippine Islands, and the Japanese assets frozen by the United States. Relations between the United States and Japan had been deteriorating long before the attack. As tensions between the two nations escalated, the United States made Pearl Harbor the home port of the Pacific Fleet, a group of U.S. Navy vessels in the Pacific Ocean. Hawaii was not a state at the time, and the fleet had only moved from California a year earlier. While these discussions were going on, a Japanese fleet of 33 naval vessels and a carrier-borne air force of 360 planes was steaming towards the Hawaiian Islands. So why weren't the aircraft detected by radar? I told you a little bit about that, but let me drop it here and I'll continue. Some accounts report that radar did pick up incoming aircraft, but this information was ignored because officers on duty thought they were American B-17s arriving from the mainland. It was a quiet Sunday morning, and many military personnel were ashore for the weekend, and others were still asleep on their ships. Most of the 780 anti-aircraft guns were not manned. The tropical Paradise Island became a graveyard to thousands, and the events of the prior days signaled the entrance of the United States into a war with Japan and her allies, Germany and Italy. Those were dark days for this country, and World War II was the most devastating war in history. Over the radio, President Roosevelt informed the American people of the brutal attack on our sovereignty. He asked Congress for a declaration of war against Japan, and that all Americans can't come together to mobilize for war. Roosevelt called December 7, 1941, a date that will live in infamy. Probably the most famous single defender is a person by the name of Doris Dory Miller, an African-American cook who went beyond his duty assignment and training when he took control of an unattended anti-aircraft gun on which he had no training and used it to fire on attacking planes while bombs were hitting his ship. And he was awarded the Navy Cross, and I hope to talk a little bit more about him later. But Gordon, can you once again come aboard with any comments? And if you have none, could you call on for check-ins and then return to me and I'll continue. KY6B from Kilo 6 Sierra United November.
Surely. Thanks, Kathy. Gordon here, KY6B. The first comment I'd like to make is Roosevelt's statement of this date will live in infamy. Just a great book was written after World War II called The Day of Infamy. And if anybody has the opportunity that has not read it, they should. As I was growing up, after all of this fanfare, I got a hold of the book, and I think through the years I've read that at least three or four times. It's just a great coverage of what we were all facing at that time. Okay, ladies and gentlemen, we're looking for additional contribution here tonight. If you have nothing to add, just come on and say hello and good evening. If you have memories, you were there, you were part of the situation after Pearl Harbor, why, let us know and tell us just what it was all about. KY6V, looking for check-in, suffixes only, and call now, please.
RMO?
Victor X-Ray Papa.
I like that, Gary. That was very apropos. I was just finishing my last scenario around terra firma. You didn't say it that way. Go ahead, sir. KY6V.
Well, thank you, sir. I had a comment, is what I had. And it was in regard to the Mitsubishi Zero, which was a great airplane. No two ways about it, and clearly, the Japanese had air superiority in the very early days of the war, but you have to give a couple of planes their due that the Corsair was definitely its superior, and nothing was going to touch the P-51, both planes used in the Pacific theater, so I just throw my 2 cents worth in on that, and maybe your comments, sir, as a pilot. We will turn it back to KY6V. This is KC2RMO.
Yeah. You know, I really stretch out for the P-51. That was a great airplane. I've never had the opportunity to fly one. They bring some in at Oshkosh up in Wisconsin for the fly-in from time to time. But I'd love to get behind the throttles of that and poke a couple of holes in the clouds. Thank you for that, Gary. And I see that, according to my screen here, I was doubling with the VXP. I'm sorry about that. Rick, good evening to you, sir. And how's the temp in Ohio? Over.
This is N1 VXP. 1 degree colder than Gary, but only at 19. Of course, Gary, you're 20 degree Fahrenheit and 20 speed. Brings that down to a chilly 4. That is cold. My only comment is I had two uncles that both were in the Navy after. One was about a month after Pearl Harbor, and the other one came in about maybe a year after Pearl Harbor. Both hit the Pacific. And I had heard a number of stories from both of them of what they thought was the good thing and the bad thing about Pearl Harbor. I asked them, I said, what do you mean by good? And they said, well, one mentioned that it was at a time when, I don't know, there was some talk in the history of the fact that the United States was still using World War I era ships. And if we would have gone to war with Japan with those ships, we would have been in real big trouble because we didn't know that the Japanese had designed ships that were so much better. But it was, you know, December 7th was instilled in me from both of my uncles to remember that date. And even my father said the same thing. He said, we should never forget, always remember, and always never dwell on the past. But let me drop for a second. I think in answering to Kathy's question about battleships, I remember reading in my history that the USS Missouri, where they did sign the end of World War II with Japan, was also it was decommissioned for a while, then it was brought back to service off and on throughout the years. And the last I heard was it was used in Desert Storm, but they were talking about decommissioning it after that for good. But just thought I'd pass that on. I've been watching and hearing a lot of great stories about all the great finds that they have found from World War II and the Pearl Harbor area. And 1PXP, back to net control.
Very good. Well, thanks for that, Rick. KY6V here for Southcars. You know, in my humble opinion, what the Japanese didn't realize when they did that sneak attack is they woke up a lion. And we've proved that. You know, just remember the greats of the Lion class, Betty the Riveter, and Kilroy was here, and, you know, the stories can just go on and on. Okay, anybody else before I turn it back to Kathy, please? KY6V, looking for check-ins. All right, Miss Sunshine, K6SUN from KY6V, you are up.
Well, thank you so much, Gordon, for allowing me that little bit of rest. But interesting information thus far, and I hope to give some information about some of the ships, maybe the damage they suffered, and maybe some of their losses. And thank you so much, Rick, for sharing that. I will try to tell that student, you know, and I this. one particular student, at times, not so much with myself, but the other teacher that works with me, he has issues. And, you know, for him to come up and ask me that, I thought that was very valuable. But, you know, a day that will live in infamy, that always rings in my ear every time I think of it and celebrate Pearl Harbor. And I, you know, I'm not thinking of celebrating it, but remembering it, because it's a part of history, and it's a part of my parents. They were married pretty much during that time, and that's what I'm going to share. So, because December 7th is today, I thought it would be an appropriate time for all of us to share our thoughts and our comments. You know, I'm going to share some of my thoughts. We've heard already from Gordon. He was there at the time. Some of us weren't born yet, like Gary and myself, and you, Rick, too, and anyone else that wasn't born before, you know, 1941. But, you know, Gordon, I want to just throw it out there to tell you to come aboard at any point, and I want to throw it to you so at some point you can share about the bomb shelter and about your trip. But we'll do that a little bit later. Let me drop it here. I'm going to tell you a little bit about my parents and what they shared with me. My parents were married on July 21st, 1941. I remember my parents telling us about visiting the Sioux Locks there in Michigan and the strict security. I was not born at the time, but I have heard stories from my parents, and that is what I would like to contribute tonight. Because other than the history of Pearl Harbor and what it should mean to all of the Americans, I do not have personal information on Pearl Harbor like Gordon does. But after Japan bombed Pearl Harbor, my dad was drafted. My parents had only been married a short time, and my mother was pregnant with my oldest brother. It was not long, though, that my dad returned home, because back then, I believe, if you were married and especially expecting a child, you were exempt from serving. I was born in the state of Michigan, and a major tourist attraction in the Upper Peninsula is the Sioux Locks. So what I want to share with you this evening is a little bit of the part the Sioux Locks played in the war. During World War II, and particularly after the U.S. was attacked at Pearl Harbor in 1941, concern turned to the locks and the shipping channel at Sault Ste. Marie. A substantial military presence was established to protect the locks from a possible attack by the Nazi German aircraft from the north. The new development of long-range bombers created fears of a sudden air raid. Military strategists studied polar projection maps, which indicate that the air distance from occupied Norway to the town was about the same as the distance from Norway to New York. That direct route of about 3,000 miles is over terrain where there were few observers and long winter nights. Let me drop it here once again. A joint Canadian and U.S. committee called the Permanent Joint Board on Defense drove for the installation of anti-aircraft defense and associated units of the United States Army Air Forces and Royal Canadian Air Force to defend the locks. An anti-aircraft training facility was established about 62 miles north of Sault Ste. Marie on the shores of Lake Superior. Barrage balloons were installed, and early warning radar devices were established at five locations in northern Ontario to watch for incoming aircraft. Military personnel were established to guard sensitive parts of the transportation infrastructure. A little over 1 year later, in January 1943, most of these facilities and defenses were deemed excessive and removed. Let me drop it here once again. So in visits to the locks, while I lived in Michigan, and since that time, I have seen increased security. You're no longer able to go down on the sidewalks to the locks. You have platforms where you can see the ships come through. So it is my belief that it is only was Pearl Harbor, but more recently 9/11. You know, as a history teacher and one who always wants to recognize those who have served their country, I always want to make my children aware of the freedoms and the security they now share that may not have been available if it was not for those who defend our country. So why is it not of value or publicized or honored anymore? Why does no one celebrate this day like so many others? And what can be done to involve our school children in these events? I told you about my children at Data House. They know this information when asked, and many with quite detailed information, while my children at Dale Casson's have no clue. And they tell me, who cares? It doesn't involve them. So why and what can be changed? So with that, once again, Mr. Gordon, KY6V, I'm going to throw it to you for any comments, and then to check in anyone that would like to come aboard.
Okay. Thanks, Kathy. Gordon, KY6V here. I'm going to leave those answers to the audience. Those are very upfront questions and probably should be discussed in depth. You had asked for me to mention what I've already told you about the bomb shelter that my father made, or had made, I guess I should say. I had mentioned earlier in the program that my father was, at this point in time, managing the Kona Telephone Company on the Big Island of Hawaii. And I think I mentioned that about an hour into the attack, he had a whole squad of National Guard guys camped out at the central office, guarding the office, and they were actually guarding our house too because it was on the same property. But several days after this had occurred, he decided he was going to build a bomb shelter. Let me buy a nickel. And this was really something. He enlisted the crew, the telephone crew, to build a shelter. This, I might say, was a bunker's bunker. It was 20 feet deep, something like 14 by 14 in size, and the walls and the ceilings were made of telephone poles. Obviously, he had a good supply of telephone poles. And they were stacked side by side, 3 feet deep on the walls. And if you think about this, it had 248 telephone poles just for the four side walls and another 48 for the roof. So it was never needed, I might add. You know, it was never needed as a bomb shelter, but it was one neat, good place for a four-year-old kid to play. With that, do we have any check-ins at this point, please? Gordon, KY6V for South Cars.
RMO?
Yes, sir. We got to get together and make a song out of that, what I was just saying. Go ahead, Gary, and thank you.
Hey, thank you, sir. I'm wondering if that thing's still standing today. That's a impregnable structure. I mean, come on. That's like great stuff. Wow. You know? If you consider what Kathy was talking about, why is this not celebrated today? Or remembered today to any extent? Or I guess probably more properly to say is why is it not remembered to any extent or recognized? I think it has to do with the general dumbing down of the population of the United States, that from the beginning, kids are taught that it's not cool to be smart, and they lose interest in academics early, and teachers try like crazy to get these kids motivated, but they're up against some pretty tough opposition, and they get it in the media, they get it at home, they get it from peers all around them. It just isn't cool to be smart. It isn't cool to be in tune with anything that has to do with learning. Let me buy a nickel, and it cost them, and it cost us as a nation too. We make generations of kids that are less than inspired by things around them, and You have to know where you came from to know where you're going, and history is our best path to the future, you know. But there's kids out there, a lot of kids, you know, they can't even spell history, you know, and that's a sad state of affairs. And until we do something about that, then it's just going to be that way, and it's just too bad, because we have some important things that people need to know to be good citizens in this country that are rooted in the past of our history. We can only hope that enough folks latch on to it until the time where people can really kind of get back into learning things again, and maybe things will get a little bit better. But that's my trip to the soapbox. I'll turn it back to the net. This is KC2RMO. Back to you, sir.
Well, thank you for that, Gary. That's very profound, sir. You know, I have to admit that I guess I was part and parcel one of those kids when I was growing up. I hated history. I didn't like my history teachers, and I didn't like the subject, and, you know, on it went. But at some point, and I don't know what that point was, I started to realize the value. And I'm just focusing on history right now. How it can teach you. How you can think about how they were thinking back then as to how you should be thinking now. And, you know, on goes the story. And then the sad part here is that these kids that we're trying to educate are our lifeline. They are the next generation. They will be the ones in vogue. And if they're not equipped for it, holy mackerel, Andy. Any other check-ins before I send it back to Kathy, please? KY6V, over.
XCX, I guess I'd better weigh in on that, over.
You know, being a Texan, I'll bet you can do it in grand style. Thanks, Woody. Go ahead, sir.
Well, you know, you know the old saying that those who don't study history are destined to relive it. Look at a lot of our politicians now. This is N5XCX, back to net.
Oh, I love that comment. I'd love to post that right on the top of our website, Woody. Thank you. Go ahead, Kathy, K6SUN, KY6V.
Well, I want to thank you, Gordon, and Woody, and Gary, for coming aboard and sharing your thoughts. And I know we're not, our net is not about education, but, you know, you pretty much said it, Gary. Some of the kids don't value the history. They don't think it will involve them. But, you know, a lot of that has to do with the teacher themselves. You know, what can they do to interest these kids? That's why my data house kids are very interested in reading. They will not put books down. You know, it's anything that interests them. And they do a lot of reading in history as well as other topics. But, you know, and the data house, like I said, they were so intent in listening to this video and to watching the video and asking questions. It has a lot to do with the person that's teaching them and being, you know, respecting the kids for their thoughts and giving them interesting things to do. So with that, I'm going to continue on. I'm going to talk about a little bit about remembering Pearl Harbor. But, you know, I see Mr., you know, Gordon, I see Mr. OVI popping in and out, and I hope he comes aboard, if nothing else, but to share, just to say hi to us this evening. But, you know, before I go on and talk about remembering Pearl Harbor, Gordon, if you're back there, and I know you are, I'd like you to make some thoughts. You left Hawaii when you were 4 or 5 years old, I believe. And I think it was your parents were afraid of what had happened in Pearl Harbor, and they wanted a safer life for you and themselves. So can you tell us what happened when you left Pearl Harbor and the age. You know, I want to say one thing, though. I want you to take me to Hawaii, Gordon, so I can see this bomb shelter. Who knows? It may still be there. It had to be an interesting thing to play in. So back to you, KY6V.
I have no idea if that thing collapsed and fell in or just what, or they turned it in, I shouldn't say this, to a cesspool or something. But those were the days, and, you know, days change. Kathy, I think you're alluding to my boat ride across the Pacific. You know, we did this in early 1942, just a number of months after Pearl Harbor, and the reason was the whole Pacific area was turning into a turmoil. Not only Pearl Harbor, but things that were following very quickly. So my parents decided we would be safer moving to the mainland, and San Francisco was the location to be exact. This was done by booking tickets on the Madison liner, the Lurline. I remember this vividly, and I was only early five. The ship had been painted gray. The portholes were painted black and kept locked tight. There were lifeboat drills on this craft after we took off. Seemed like every day to me. And although the ship was scheduled to land in San Francisco, Kathy, it was diverted to Los Angeles when Japanese subs were sighted in the waters off of northern coast of California. So the end result is I grew up in California, okay? I've been back to the islands to visit about four times, maybe, since Pearl Harbor, and the last was in 1992. So there you have the story of my my side of being reincarnated. KY6V. Go ahead, Kathy.
Well, thanks so much for sharing that. You know, and that, you know, as a youngster, that also had to be traumatic, getting on a boat and heading across the waters and to a new area. And you have a lot to share, which you've shared with us tonight. So thank you so much for that. But let me go on a little bit further. We're going to remember Pearl Harbor. You know, if I said to you the words September 11th, I imagine most people in North America and all of you here tonight would be able to associate that date almost automatically with a horrific terrorist attacks in New York City, Washington, D.C., and Pennsylvania in 2001. At one time, there was a similar, almost automatic association of December 7th to another surprise attack on America, the Japanese military raid on Pearl Harbor, Hawaii in 1941. More than 2,300 American servicemen lost their lives that day. The Pacific Fleet was dealt a crippling blow. Remember, Pearl Harbor would become the mantra for whipping up patriotic fervor during the war that followed that day of infamy. Many heroes emerged from the crucible of that awful day as well. One man, a chief aviation ordnance man at the small naval base at Kanawha Bay, was one of those unlikely heroes. When he died in 2010 at the age of 100, he was the oldest living Medal of Honor recipient recognized for his courageous actions that day 71 years ago. His name was John William Flynn. As we just recognized the 72nd anniversary of Pearl Harbor today, let me share his story. Remember I told you a little bit earlier, he was a cook who went out and manned those guns. So let me share this with you as we continue in the program this evening. Chief Finn was sleeping in that Sunday morning, looking forward to spending a little extra time with his wife, Alice. Being the chief ordnance officer at Kanawha Bay, he was a little puzzled by noise that sounded like a 50 caliber machine gun fire coming from the nearby airfield. No practices or exercises were scheduled. There was a knock at the door, and a neighbor told Finn that he was needed at the hangar. Accompanied by two other Navy servicemen, Finn was driving in his 1938 Ford along the Hawaiian roadway when a small airplane came in low. He knew immediately that the engine sound was not from one of the reconnaissance aircraft assigned to the base. As the plane's wing tipped, as it began a run at the base, Finn saw the telltale Japanese Zero insignia and realized that Kanoa Bay was under attack. Kanoa Bay, and Gordon, if you're there, I may be pronouncing this wrong, is almost 5 minutes airtime from Pearl Harbor. So many consider the attack there the first official American action of World War II. Let me drop it here a moment. Arriving at the airfield, Finn was immediately immersed in the battle. First, he went to the armory and broke out machine guns and ammunition to mount some kind of resistance to the Japanese onslaught. Then he set up a 50 caliber machine gun in a very vulnerable position and began to return fire against the straggling Zeros. One plane was shot down, and some attributed the kill to Finn in his brazen defense of the airfield. Asked about his bold attempt to defend his turf, Finn said he was simply outraged at the attack. "I was so mad," he said. "I guess I didn't have the sense to be frightened." Hit by shrapnel over a dozen times, Finn refused to leave his gun post until he was under direct orders. Then he helped set up a makeshift defenses for the base before finally seeking medical attention early Monday morning, nearly 18 hours after the attack began. He was hospitalized and wasn't released until Christmas Eve. 9 months later, the newly promoted Lieutenant Finn traveled to Pearl Harbor with his wife. There he boarded the USS Enterprise and was awarded the Medal of Honor by Admiral Nimitz. Like most heroes, John Finn never saw his actions as heroic. He humbly described himself as a good old Navy man doing his job. After his retirement from the Navy in 1956, John and Alice returned to their native Southern California. Alice died in 1998, but John pushed on, still patriotic and still a hero at all who ever knew him or heard his story from that first Pearl Harbor, December 7th, 1941. I'm going to share this with you before I once again call on you, Gordon, so I hope you're standing tall, but let me drop it here for a moment. This is what Lieutenant John Finn cited. "For extraordinary heroism, distinguished service, and devotion above and beyond the call of duty, during the first attack by Japanese airplanes on a naval base in Kanoa Bay, territory of Hawaii, on December 7, 1941, Lieutenant Finn promptly secured and manned a 50 caliber machine gun mounted on an instruction stand in a completely exposed section of the parking ramp, which was under heavy enemy machine gun fire. Although painfully wounded many times, he continued to man this gun and to return the enemy fire, and with telling effect throughout the enemy strafing and bombing attacks, and with complete disregard for his own personal safety. It was only by specific orders, like I said, that he was persuaded to leave his post to seek medical attention. Following first aid treatment, although obviously suffering much pain and moving with great difficulty, he returned to the squadron and actively supervised the rearming of the returning planes. His extraordinary heroism and conduct in this action were in keeping with the highest traditions of the U.S. Naval Service." And you as a Navy man, Mr. Gordon, I'm going to throw it over to you for any comments, any thoughts, and then let's see who you can get check in before we start winding down this evening.
Well, thanks, Kathy. I see we're about a couple of minutes into the second hour, and that's just doing great. Gordon here, KY6V, that's Kaneohe Bay is the way that that's pronounced. Kathy, the Hawaiian language, and you being an English teacher, probably have a little distraction between the two dialects. The thing to notice in the Hawaiian language is that each of the Hawaiian words starts with a vowel. And if not, it certainly ends with a vowel. So the bay that you're describing is called Kaneohe. Okay, ladies and gentlemen, any check-ins at this point? Tell us about your recollection. If you were born after all of this, what have you heard on the subject? Did they cover it in school for you? Did you have any involvement with Pearl Harbor or the days after? What stories do you have that you could tell us? Check-ins, please. KY6V, over. All right, Pete, I saw you key up, but your audio was almost non-existent. Try it again, sir, and come aboard. Over.
I don't have my other program that's aiding this audio problem on right now. I just had to redo it. Redo the whole thing. I hope now it's up again, as I see it on my bar graph here. But anyway, getting over the audio difficulty. The only thing I got to say about this whole war bit about Okinawa, at the place there, is that on the way to Okinawa, I had the opportunity of being bivouacked at the airport, and I said, I'm not going to stick around the airport until the airplane gets fixed. There's a crack in the window that said to work on the airplane to get that crack finished. So they told us, unequivocally, that you got a half a day of R&R before you head into Okinawa. So, okay. We just took a trip around the interior and also the Half Moon Beach, they call it. Looked at all that beautiful beach and I said, my gosh, this was a war zone, and now you're looking at it, it's a tourist attraction. And seeing all the attributes or the monuments to each cause and preserve that in history, I think that's an admirable thing to do. So people never forget the story. And to keep the story alive, I think they should have a nice little get together every 10 years and keep that thing, keep the spirit alive. And what happened there. And in a nutshell, that's about it for me. It's a beautiful island. And it's very well worth it to protect it and to keep it beautiful. And hopefully the next crowd that's going to take over is going to do the same thing to keep up the history. Okay, before I ask you, Victor India, back to you, KY6V.
Okay, thank you very much for that, Pete. Yeah, it sounds like your system is reverted back to this automatic gain control. You know, you start off very weak, and then in a short order, you're up almost, but not quite to what normal audio level would be. What year was that? Do you remember, Pete, when you had your four-hour R&R on Oahu? Over.
Let me think of it. It was in the anything from 64 to 67 or 68. In that time frame, over.
67, 68, okay. Yeah, that's what your audio is doing. It's starting off at a very low level and starting to increase gain. Well, I imagine in 67 or 68, the islands had started to somewhat come back to normal. The hotels were probably blooming on Waikiki Beach. Cost you $5 to wash a pair of socks in the hotel, and six-pack of beer was probably about $9, and don't buy any gasoline type thing. The last time I was back out there was 1992, as I had mentioned earlier, and I'll tell you what, the cost of living is just absolutely atrocious. But it's particularly for the tourists. If you're a Kama'aina, Pete, which is a native-born individual like myself, and you have family that's still out there, you know, you can handle this living cost pretty easily because they know where to go and who to talk to and where to buy it. But it's a story within itself. Thanks, Pete. Appreciate you being here. Anybody else wishing to check in at this point? Come now, KY6V. Okay, Miss Kathy, I see that we're now 9 minutes into the second hour and counting. K6SUN from KY6V.
All right, Gordon, thanks so much. And thank you, Pete, for coming aboard and sharing and checking in this evening. You know, at some point, I want to go a little bit, Gordon, into some of the ships. But knowing you were born in the Hawaiian Islands during the time of Pearl Harbor, before I go into some of these final thoughts, each of the ships were named after states. You know, Nevada, Arizona, Oklahoma, Tennessee, California. I also see Utah and... See, cruisers there are named, one of them was named Honolulu. Destroyers were named a little bit differently. And do you have a reason that they named it after states? I'm sort of curious. It's not all the states because we didn't have that many ships. But, you know, it's mainly, I mean, it's not only the western states. We have Tennessee and Maryland and Pennsylvania. West Virginia. Do you have an answer for that before I go on? And maybe you don't, but I'm just sort of curious. Do you have an answer why the ships were named like that? Over to you, KY6B.
No, I really don't, Kathy, but I would assume that this is a subject that's easily researched on our internet system today. But that's very true. You know, at that period of time, most of the ships were named after states. But look at us now. The new ships coming off the rollers at the shipbuilding plants are coming up with presidents' names. The Franklin D. Roosevelt, you know, the Bush, the this, the that. So I think the pendulum is swinging, I guess is what I'm trying to say. Go ahead, Kathy, KY6V.
All right, thank you so much. I was just wondering, and I hope to share that with everyone about some of the various battleships and the cruisers, you know, maybe their hits and maybe when they were returned to service or maybe they're still in service, who knows. But let me continue on, and we're starting to wind down with final thoughts. So we hope that if you haven't checked in this evening, you'll come aboard with, if no comments, just simply a check-in. But regardless of your age or your interest in World War II, a visit to Pearl Harbor, Hawaii, is an extremely emotional experience. There are many war memorials across America, but there's something truly different there. You know, at 7:55 on that sunny morning in 1941 of December, 183 Japanese warplanes swooped out of a cloudless sky and demolished the U.S. Pacific Fleet docked at Pearl Harbor. It was this single catastrophic event, not the invasion of Poland, the Battle of Britain, or the persecution of the Jews that finally dragged the United States into World War II. But you already knew that. What you didn't know and won't until you set foot on this beautiful island is that Pearl Harbor has a way of pulling you back in time and wrapping its suntan fingers around your heart like no other place in the world. The Hawaiian Islands are truly America's paradise, Gordon, you know I always want to visit there. And you are seduced by the perfumed scent of tropical flowers and soft kiss of Pacific trade winds the moment you arrive in Honolulu. And don't forget that lei that you usually get. Here, stress has a magical way of evaporating from your body, and the last thing you can imagine as you close your eyes and stretch out on a balmy Oahu beach is the thought of hundreds of killing machines suddenly screaming down upon you. It is this horrible paradox that will forever haunt Pearl Harbor and leave its indelible mark upon your soul. The Japanese dive bombers are long gone, but the wondrous allure of this tropical island remains, and so do the bodies of over 1,000 American sailors still entombed in the hull of the USS Arizona. In just under 2 hours, the Japanese had sunk 4 U.S. battleships, the Arizona, the California, the Oklahoma, and the West Virginia. The Nevada was beached, and the other 3 battleships at Pearl Harbor received considerable damage. Let me drop it here for just a moment. Also damaged were 3 light cruisers, 4 destroyers, 1 mine layer, 1 target ship, and 4 auxiliaries. And I'm not sure what an auxiliary is, so as a Navy man, Gordon, maybe you can share that with me. Of the U.S. aircraft, the Japanese managed to destroy 188 and damage an additional 159. The death toll among Americans was quite high. A total of over 2,300 servicemen were killed, and over 1,000 or 1,100 were wounded. 68 civilians were also killed, and 35 were wounded. Nearly half of the servicemen that were killed, as I've said before, were on the Arizona. All this damage was done by the Japanese, who suffered very few losses themselves. Just 29 aircraft and 5 midget subs. The news of the attack on Pearl Harbor quickly spread throughout the United States. The public was shocked and outraged. They wanted to strike back. It was time to join World War II. Let me drop it here. I'm going to make a final comment here about what that little video at school told me, and I want to share that. You know, at 12:30 p.m. on the day following the attack on Pearl Harbor, President Franklin Delano Roosevelt gave that address to the Congress. At the end of the speech, Roosevelt asked Congress to declare war. With only one dissenting vote, Congress declared war, officially bringing the United States into World War II. Many ships were destroyed and many were restored to continue in battle. And what we hear today, and maybe someone can clarify this for me, is that those surviving members of the Arizona wished to have their ashes entombed on the Arizona. While showing the video to my children on Friday, there's some interesting information on the battleship of Oklahoma that I would like to share with you tonight. On December 7, 1941, Oklahoma was sunk by several bombs and torpedoes during the attack. A total of 429 crew members died, and I think Gordon shared that with us, when she capsized in Battleship Row. In 1943, Oklahoma was righted and salvaged. Let me drop it here for just a moment. However, unlike most of the other battleships that were recovered following Pearl Harbor, the Oklahoma was too damaged to return to duty. She was eventually stripped of all her remaining armaments and superstructure before being sold for scrap in 1946. She sank in a storm while being towed from Oahu to Hawaii to a breaker's yard in San Francisco Bay in 1947. So, I wanted to share that with you. This is Kilo 6 Sierra United November. Mr. Gordon, KY6V, could I have you again come aboard with any comments, any thoughts? And then open it once again for some, maybe some final check-ins this evening.
Well, thanks, Kathy. You know, I'm sitting back here wondering if I should ask this question or not. It's not politically correct, probably. And this is Gordon, KY6V, but this one dissenting vote when Franklin D. Did his number with Congress, was it a he or a she, and was it a Republican or a Democrat? Over.
Funny, Gordon. I really can't tell you. Did they have female dissenting votes back then? I'm not sure. Republican or Democrat, or maybe it was independent. Don't have the answer, but it sure would be interesting to find out. And we won't go there because it's not politically correct, and it's probably not correct to say either female or male. But that is interesting. That was an interesting comment I found. I'm wondering why that one dissenting vote decided it wasn't a time to go into war. But maybe that's something for me to research as a history teacher. I'll turn it back to you, see if you can get some check-ins. And I actually want to go through some of the information about the battleships, unless maybe our backup could come aboard and share some of that. You know, maybe he knows that, because he's a history buff. With that, I'll turn it back to you, Gordon. See who you can get to come aboard.
Okay. I'll do it to it, Kathy. Thank you. I'm not sure that I would pursue my question very much further, because the state of the state in our political razzmatazz that's going on right now, if it was a Republican, the Democrats would take this to the map and bring it back up, and if it was the other way around, why, then the Republicans would do it. So maybe it ought to just stay dormant. Ladies and gentlemen, we're getting close to the end. We're 20 minutes into the second hour. This is South Cars. This is the Global Family Hour. Tonight we're discussing the 72 years passed from Pearl Harbor on December 7th, 1941. Do you have any comments that you'd like to offer, or just say hello? Call now, please. Over.
RMO, and I have the answers to two burning questions.
Okay. If you feel comfortable to let this loose, you may be opening up a new political ploy that we're going to hear in the news tomorrow. Go ahead, Gary, KY6V, over.
Well, I do not know the party affiliation of the person that cast the dissenting vote, but I do know the name. Her name was Jeanette Rankin, and she cast the sole vote against going into World War II. Rankin was a committed pacifist, she had a long history in Congress of voting against military or you know, military actions, that sort of thing. That's item one. Item two, being the list of battleships that were named after states, or why battleships were named after states. It was actually an act of Congress back in the middle 1800s. With the exception of the Kearsarge, all ships were by act of Congress named after states, and only two states have not had a ship named after them, and I'm trying to find that right now. Believe it or not, one was Hawaii, never had a battleship named after it, and I'm almost thinking it was Alaska was the other one. I'm looking through the article right now, and I'm trying to find that, but it was, where was it? No, don't have it there, so I'll have to get back to you on the other one. Hawaii definitely did not have a battleship named after it, and I'm pretty sure that that Alaska as well didn't. So the two later states never had that. But by law, for a long time, that's how we named our battleships. And we'll go back to the net. This is KC2RMO.
Well, that's great information. Thanks, Gary. I'm starting to believe that the way that this unfolds, it depends on the class of the vessel. Battleships for states, aircraft carriers for presidents. There was a ship involved in Pearl Harbor called the Honolulu. But what class vessel she was, I have no idea. Gary, any comments? Over.
Yeah, I know they do vary the naming conventions by class, and they also apparently split that down a little bit more, too, so that if, you know, for instance, if you're a battleship, you're a state. If you're a cruiser, you're this. And then you have different classes of battleships, you know, like fast battleships or South Dakota class or Iowa class battleships. So they have a lot of divisions within that too. So now whether, you know, you start adding different naming conventions depending upon that, I'm not really sure. You're right. There are different names for different types of ships. So that if you're a it was Alaska and Hawaii, by the way. It was Alaska and Hawaii, the two later states. Never got a battleship named after them. But you're right. If you're an aircraft carrier, you get a different name, a different type of name, than you are if you're a battleship. And it is interesting. It goes back a long ways too. When you go back and do the research on it, you're talking about from the mid to late 1800s to date. So there's a lot to it. There's more than meets the eye. It's KC2RMO going back to the net.
I find it very interesting, Gary. Thank you. I imagine these people who are involved in naming the ships have quite a controversy on their hands because, you know, we're producing some ships that we have never produced before. Missile guidance ships and high fire speedy type land craft, and geez, it goes on and on. Okay, thanks, Gary. Any other check-ins, please? KY6V, and this is South Cars.
VXP.
I must have missed you that last round. I'm sorry, Rick. I'm getting a little slow on the trigger, I guess. Go ahead, Mr. Ohio. Over.
No, you didn't miss me. I put a comment in the text box, and then I checked in. Something that I remember my grandfather had mentioned that, yes, it does date back to the late 1800s when they named the ships after states, and it was quite surprising that, like I say, there were World War One vintage ships that had the names. And something that I remember hearing in history that the Japanese made one big mistake. They were supposed to do a second attack on Pearl Harbor, but because there were no aircraft carriers, they decided, there could be planes, there could be problems. So if they would have done a second attack, they would have hit the fuel depots and other critical military supply areas, which really would have done more damage than just the initial attack. But like I say, I remember hearing something about the fact that the aircraft carriers were not found in Pearl Harbor. So the Japanese decided, it could be a problem. So they decided not to do the second attack. I can imagine what could have happened if they would have done the second one. And would have been really a whole different turning point in the war. Let me drop for a second. And I have one final thought about. We can't forget that the day after we declared war on Japan, Germany declared war on the United States, thinking that we would be too involved in the Pacific War and definitely not involved heavy enough in the European to be in two wars at once. I think that we tend to forget that, and I remember my father always said, never forget December 8th as well. It's a date that nobody really thinks about, but it's something we have to remember. And 1VXP back to net control.
Well, I thank you for that. You know, my history, Rick, tells me about when Germany declared war with the United States, but I didn't associate it to December 8th. I'll have to stick that back in my memory bank or something for a further retrieval at a later date. You know, I'm a guy that, talking about the names of the ships, after the Pinta and the Santa Maria and those guys, you know, I don't keep track of it anymore. And I'll leave it at that. Thank you very much, Rick, and I'm sorry I missed you on that last turnaround. I wasn't watching the text box. Just too much going on here with running the net to stay on top of it. Anybody else for check-ins? We're winding down for last call here. Kathy has a couple of more comments, and then we'll see how it flows. Any other check-ins, please?
Okay, Rick, you're here. Over.
Over, over. Hey, you know, your audio started up where it should be. You must have done something. Go ahead, Pete.
Let me tell you something. If you had a program like Audio Creation Mode, which I'm right now in, you can just about do some things on your audio that possibly a studio can. It's a studio. I think to me it looks like a studio program. It's got all sorts of bells and whistles on the sliders and buttons on there. Too many buttons. I hate to push because I don't know what it would do to the audio other than what it's doing right now, but I'm happy to hear that the audio's good. But yeah, that situation I think we all learned the history that chain of events that happened during the one's lifetime. We should learn something from all these wars. What happened, and I think if we can keep this planet more. Peaceful. I think it would be for the better of mankind. Mankind all the time has something in his back pocket to cause a war. I don't know what it is. But I hope that washes out in time. Katie for Oscar McKinney of Back to Net Control.
Okay. Thanks, Pete. Gordon here, KY6V for South Cars. The audio is still a tad low, but it's up in a comfortable range. It's probably somewhere between 15 and maybe 20% lower than you want it, so you're going to have to play with that a little bit. And I'm hearing some clicking. I don't know if you're moving around or you're tapping a pen on the desk or something, but that's something to look into also. Well, we've sort of touched on history and the importance of it, and of course, I'm sure Kathy is very proud of that conversation, she being a rounded teacher and a history teacher, amongst other things. I feel very strongly that it's important to have an overview of what's happened in the past so you know where the heck you should make a decision going forward. And I will leave it at that. All right, Kathy, I am showing 33 minutes into the second hour. K6SUN from KY6V.
Well, thank you so much, Gordon, and thank everyone for connecting this evening. And I see Rebecca is out there. I know, Mike, you're still connected, VE3MIC. I think you said 73, but thanks for connecting to us, and I hope that you enjoy. But Gordon, I have one question for you before I go into some final comments about some of these ships. Can you explain to me what an auxiliary ship is? My information shows that there were three auxiliary ships, I believe three, that were, one was a mine layer, one was a repair ship, and one was a seaplane tender. Can you explain, and they were all hit by torpedoes or bombs, and they all had casualties on them. Can you explain me in a very short explanation what an auxiliary is? KY6B from Kilo 6 Sierra United November.
Well, I think you're picking on me tonight, Kathy. Gordon here, KY6B. You know, I only ran one tour in the Navy. And I said, it's time for me to get out and get a real job. So I'm not an authoritarian on naval practices to any degree. But an auxiliary vessel to me was always a support vessel to the rest of the fleet. Repair ship, that type of thing. And if I'm wrong, I'm wrong, Kathy. KY6V, over.
I'm not picking on you at all, but, you know, I'm not sure the branch of service Pete was in, but I know you were naval, and I'm not sure who else is out there that was in the military, so it's not that I'm picking on you, but I know you have a vast knowledge there with everything, but I think you're probably right. Just auxiliary is usually support for anything, but now I was just curious because the information I brought up I had about battleships and cruisers and destroyers and auxiliaries, and I just wanted some information. So as we conclude this evening, ladies and gentlemen, I want to throw it out there. You know, Gary out there has some very valuable information. He knew a lot about the reason the ships were named after states, and he talked about a cruiser. One of the cruisers was named Honolulu. So I'm going to throw it out there, Gordon, if that's okay, to Gary and see if he has some information for us. Maybe he's researched it. He's very valuable. You know, he's in taking classes right now. So maybe he's done a lot of research on this, and maybe he can come up with us tonight and tell us if he has any information on maybe what happened with the different ships, maybe their losses and their deceased and the bombs. And so I'm going to throw it out there to you, Gary. And if you don't have this information, that's okay, but hopefully you do. So Gary, KC2RMO, can you share any of that information with those listening?
Well, thank you, Kath, and actually do have some research here about some of the ships and the fates that they met. They're kind of broken down by the class of ship. So we'll start with the battleships. The Arizona, probably the most famous casualty of the attack, was hit by an armor-piercing bomb. It exploded. It was a total loss. The figure was 1,177 dead on that. The Oklahoma was hit by 5 torpedoes. It capsized. A total loss was 429. As Gordon mentioned, it was refloated in November 1943. It capsized and was lost while under tow to the mainland in 1947. The West Virginia, hit by 2 bombs, 7 torpedoes, was sunk, returned to service July 1944, 106 dead on that. The California, hit by 2 bombs, 2 torpedoes, it was sunk, returned to service January 1944, 100 dead on that. Let me buy a nickel. The Nevada was hit by 6 bombs, 1 torpedo, it was beached, it was returned to service October 1942, 60 dead in the attack. The Tennessee, hit by 2 bombs, returned to service February 1942, 5 dead. The Maryland, hit by 2 bombs, returned to service February 1942, 4 dead, including the float plane pilot. He was shot down. The Pennsylvania was in dry dock with the Casson and Downs. It was hit by 1 bomb. Debris from the USS Casson remained in service, though. 9 were dead in the attack. A former battleship, which was a target ship, a training ship, was the Utah, hit by 2 torpedoes. It capsized with a total loss of 64 dead. A couple of cruisers, the Helena, was hit by 1 torpedo, returned to service 1942 with 20 dead. The Raleigh, hit by 1 torpedo, returned to service February 1942. The Honolulu was a near miss, light damaged, and it remained in service by a nickel. We'll move on to destroyers that were damaged in the attack. The Cassin was in dry dock, as we mentioned before, along with the Downs and the Pennsylvania. It was hit by a bomb. It burned, returned to service in February 44. The Downs in dry dock with the Cassin and Pennsylvania caught fire from the Cassin. It burned and returned to service in 1943 in November. The Shaw was hit by three bombs, returned to service in June 1942. Now, these auxiliary ships that Kathy and Gordon were talking about, the Oglala, I'm going to spell this for you, O-G-L-A-L-A, Oglala, a mine layer, was damaged by a torpedo, hit on the Helena. It capsized. It returned to service as an engine repair ship in January 1944. The Vestal, which was a repair ship, hit by two bombs, blast and fire from the Arizona. It was beached and returned to service in August 1942. And finally, the Curtiss, which was a seaplane tender, hit by one bomb, one crashed Japanese aircraft, and returned to service January 1942. There were casualties, 19 dead on the Curtiss. And that's the rundown of damaged ships during the attack. We'll go back to the net. This is KC2RMO returning back to the net.
Well, thank you so much, Gary. You had some very valuable information. You've done a lot of research out there, and that is very valuable to everyone listening tonight. So thank you so very much for that. I want to thank everyone for being here this evening. I've enjoyed it thoroughly. It's a very important topic to myself as a history teacher. I hope that you enjoyed. But at this point, I'm going to throw it over to Mr. Gordon. He is my co-host this evening, and he has been bringing up check-ins. I'm going to have him do that, and I'm going to actually have you close this evening, Gordon, if you will, and remind everyone about our fabulous rag chew in the morning. Thank you, everyone. I've enjoyed it. I hope that this can be a podcast on our website, and you can listen to it over and over again. But thanks for contributing this evening, and thanks for being here. So KY6B, can you continue with the closing, as well as to seeing if we have any check-ins out there? Thanks for riding along with me. I appreciate it so much. This is Kilo 6 Sierra United November. Over to you, KY6B.
Muchas gracias, Senorita. KY6V here. Thank you. I've enjoyed it tonight. We've been going about an hour and 42 minutes. I would just like to say in closing, being a Kanaka, being a Hawaiian boy, and seeing that I am recording on two recording computers here at the moment, and I think you're recording also, Kathy, I would like to say to everybody, aloha, nui, kako, opu, papali, wiki wiki. And that comes from my little grass shack in Kalakakua, Hawaii, where I normally am sending out my net into the sea, where I can watch the humahuma, nukunuku, apawaz, go swimming by. Good night, everybody. This has been South Cars, the South Coast Amateur Radio Service. VOIP net schedules and general information may be found on the voip.southcars.com website. Your net controls for this evening have been Kathy, K6SUN, Gordon, KY6V, and backed up by Gary, KC2RMO. Everybody have a good evening. Servers back to normal use and abuse. Come by and see us in the morning. It's going to be Ask an Elmer, 10 o'clock in the morning Eastern time, and that will be spearheaded by both Gary in Syracuse, RMO, and Jim in Georgia, Quebec Yankee. Just changed his call, and I haven't figured that out yet. Good night, everybody, and bye-bye, KY6V Clear.